6 July, cumpleaños, 15 years of age. No birthday fiesta, but mother said to take some extra coins from her purse and buy some carne asada or something nice at the market. Only, no coins. The painter's wife was there today, buying buckets of food, getting ready for a fiesta at her house from the looks of it. But no servant. The little queen looked like a burro under all her baskets. Two bananas fell on the street behind her as she walked. Down at the end of the market, men were unloading a wagon of green tamale corn in the husk, stacking the ears in tall pyramids. The queen pointed through her bundles, making a man fill a big sack for her. La Perla said, "Stop staring, guapo. Just because it's your birthday, you don't get any girl you want. Your eyes will roll in the street behind her like those bananas." How is she going to carry that corn? She'll collapse for sure. So, go talk to her. Tell her for 10 pesos you'll carry it. She'll pay you. She's rich. Go on, go. La Perla pushed with her little hands like knives. Crossing the street was like walking through water. Señora Rivera, would you like some help carrying something? She set down her two baskets, picked up the great bulging sack, and handed it over with a thump. Go ahead. Anybody has the right to make a kite from his pants. There was no further discussion. Following behind her was a whole conversation by itself. Her swirling skirts, her short legs walking as fast as a little dog's, her proud head crowned with its circle of braids. Make way for the queen, pulling a boy behind like a kite on a string. Her house was down 4 streets and over one, on Londres, at the corner of Allende. She walked through the tall front door without saying, "Follow," or "Stop here," or anything, sweeping past an old woman with her apron bunched up in one hand, who took the sack of corn and went away. But the queen stood where she was, framed in the entry by bright sunlight beyond. The high wall enclosed a beautiful courtyard inside, with the rooms of the house all around it. It was impossible to turn away from the sight of her strange little figure there, the palms and fig trees waving behind her like fans. The courtyard was a dream. Birds in cages, fountains, plants sprawling from their pots, vines climbing the trunks of the trees. And in that jungle, the painter, sprawled in a chair in the sun, wearing the wrecked clothes of a beggar and the glasses of a professor. He was smoking a cigar and reading a newspaper. "Oh, good morning, sir."
"Who is it?"
He barely glanced up. His wife gave a warning look. "Sir, the nation rejoices in your return."
"The nation considers me to be worth approximately 2 peanuts at most."
"Nevertheless, sir, do you need a plaster mixer?" Now the paper dropped onto the round belly and he looked up, taking off his glasses, his bulging eyes like 2 boiled eggs in that enormous head. He glared for a moment, then brightened.
"Sweet buns, how I've missed you! Those other boys are hopeless!"
The queen stood staring with such a fierce frown, her dark eyebrows joined in a handshake over the bridge of her nose. But her mouth remained amused as she watched her husband get up to clap this strange boy on the back, hiring him on the spot. The great mural grows down the staircase day by day, like a root into the ground. Presidents and soldiers and Indians all coming alive. The sun opens its eyes. A landscape grows like grass, and today fire came out of the volcano. Señor Alva says the painter is working his way toward the beginning of time, at the mural center, where the eagle will sit on a cactus and eat the serpent, home at last. Señor Rivera makes charcoal sketches over the wall, and every day begins a new section. He frames the scene with long lines sloping to a point on the distant horizon, the vanishing point. Then holds the picture in his head as he works to paint in shadows, then color, finishing a panel as fast as we can mix plaster for the next one. The slake lime paste burns our hands. White marble dust becomes the air we breathe. Today he scolded the pigmentist because the blue paste was too blue, but the plaster was perfect. 14 October. Ambassador Senator Morrow died in his sleep while his wife was playing golf. All the newspapers are about him. Best friend of Mexico. His daughter's husband is Charles Lindbergh, so he only has to wave his cap at the crowd and everyone cheers or mourns. Mother says she had that ambassador pegged from the start, the type to love his wife and die young. She's sore because P.T. did not produce the cash after all. 26 October, Luna de Octubre. Some of the boys at work say the painter is going away again. Señor Alva says they want to make a big show of his paintings in a museum in New York. But his paintings are on the walls of Mexico. How could they leave here? 12 November. He's gone. He took Señor Alva with him. In the forgotten white land at the bottom of our wall, the eagle has no cactus, no snake for his lunch. He can't find home. The story of Mexico waits for its beginning. Part 2. Washington, D.C., 1932 to 1934. Initialed V.B. 1 January, 1932. For a son on the wrong track, mother has found a different set of rails and packed him off on them. Lock, stock, and barrel, she said with a raised glass, describing a firearm in its entirety. This train runs north from the city. At the little, struggling desert towns, children run alongside, reaching toward the windows. Then come the rocky flatlands where the towns give up altogether. Spiked maguey plants reach out of the ground like hands, a great clawed creature trapped underground. At evening, the light drained and the land went from brown to umber, then dried blood, then ink. In the morning, the pigments reversed, the same colors rising out of a broad, flat land that looks like a mural. This compartment has one other person, an American named Green, who got on at Huichapan. Not old, but he stares out the window like an old person, rocking in rhythm with the suitcases over his head and water in a glass in his hand. He sips a little every hour, as if it's the last water on earth. Overnight, some flames appeared in the distance, each standing alone like a candle. Oil wells burning to remove the gases. Last night, the conductor came through to say we were 3 hours from the border and it was 12 o'clock. His privilege was to wish us a prosperous new year. He moved down the car, repeating the same news and the same privileged wish. Happy New Year, Mr. Green. Just before the border were pecan orchards, dark blocks of trees with their boughs half bright and half shadowed, lit by the electric lights of the shelleries. People working there in the dead of night, New Year's morning. The train sighed and stopped at the border, waiting for the customs agents to arrive at their offices. The whitening sky showed a thin stretch of river with dogs skulking along its shores, their upcurved tails reflected on the gray surface. The riverbank is a dumping ground, planks and metal, flaps of tarred paper. At daybreak, children began walking from the scrap piles, not a dumping ground after all, but a terrible kind of city. Women came out of the shacks, too, and last the men, straightening to unfold themselves, placing both hands against their backs, shifting their trousers and pissing in the ditches, squatting to splash their faces at the river's edge. Old men, thin as bones, walked along the stopped train, looking in the windows. They lingered at the rear until police came with sticks to beat them away from the iron-sided cars. These people look as poor as could ever be, worse than the beggars and borrachos of Mexico City, who at least always have a ballad of the revolution to sing into their shirt collars as they lean on a doorway. Here is the end of Mexico, end of the world and chapter one. This train ride is like the long, narrow cave in the sea. With luck, it might open on the other side into someplace new, but not here. 6 January. 5 days and the train has passed through many underworlds. Grass hills, dark swamps of standing trees, and now almost nothing but fields of dead sticks, immense as the sea. Not a green leaf anywhere. The gringos read magazines, failing to notice their world has nothing left alive in it. Only the Mexicans look out the windows and worry. A woman and 4 children are the only others who have come this same unimaginable distance from Mexico City. Today, when the train crossed a bridge over a high river gorge, she made the children sing for the Feast of the Kings so they wouldn't cry. She took a rosca cake from her bag, crumbling out of its paper wrappings into the worn velvet seats. The family huddled together, locking their small holiday from the inside. January 7, Federal District of North America. Lock, stock, and barrel. The human cargo arrived today at Union Station. Delivered into such fierce cold, stepping off the train felt like being thrown into water and commanded to breathe it. The Mexican mother reached her little foot down from the doorway like the feeler of a snail. The freezing air set her to panic, rolling her children up in shawls like tamales, pushing them ahead of her into the station. Adios. Would he be here? And if not? Mother had suggested no other plan if the father should fail to arrive and claim his baggage. But now here he was. A painful clap on the shoulder, the blue eyes measuring, how strange, a relative with pale eyes. Who could have picked that one from just the one tinted photograph? Of course, he must have been experiencing similar disappointments in the sun. Your train was an hour late. Sorry, sir. Ragtag boys rushed past like pigeons flushed from the bush, coshing people's suitcases into their knees. A bunch of little tramps on the rods, he said. On the rods? They ride into town on the outside of the train. The cold was killing, every breath prickling into needles of nostril ice, and clothes itching like mange after so many days. People in long coats, the howling steam engines. Finally it dawned what he'd said. These ragged boys rode outside the train. Dios mío! Where will they go now? Bunk on their ears in some hobo jungle, or else they'll go listen to the Christers. Accept the Lord for one night in exchange for a mulligan. Is mulligan a kind of money? His laugh was a loud burst, like notes exploding from a mariachi trumpet. He was amused by this empty bank of bewilderment, his son. The inside of the station was like the cathedral. So much space overhead, a great dome rising toward heaven, but not enough room down here for all the people jammed in. A grand marble doorway opened to the street, but outdoors the sun was cold, shining without heat, like an electric bulb. Crowds hurried along, unconcerned their star had no fire. Where is everybody going? Home, son. Time for a two-bit square and a working man's nap. This is nothing. You should see it Monday morning. Could a street hold more people? Inside the station, the trains were still shrieking, the sound of digestion in the belly of that monument, like an Aztec temple drinking blood. Mother's parting advice? Try to put a positive face on things. The man hates whining, let me tell you. Union Station looks like a temple.
A temple? Father gave a sideways look. How old are you now? 14?
15. 16 this summer.
Right. Temples. Built with government money by Hoover's swindlers.
He scowled at the trolley stop, as if the city had slyly shifted around behind his back while he was in the station. A freckled, pinkish man, the pale mustache discolored along its bottom edge. The photograph hadn't recorded the unheroic complexion. That skin would broil to a crisp in Mexico. One mystery solved. He dodged into the crowd and moved fast, leaving no choice but to tuck chin like a boxer and watch out for horse droppings, tugging the behemoth trunk. Mother's driver had put it on the train. Porters carried it after that. No more help now. America was help yourself.
They're planning to put up a whole string of your temples here on the south side of Pennsylvania. See that eyepopper? Washington's monument.
He pointed into a leafless park, the pale stone rising above the trees. A memory rose with it, the long, narrow box of hallway rising like a dark mouse tunnel. An echoing argument in the stairwell, Mother's hand pulling downward, back to safety.
We went in there, didn't we, one time with Mother? You remember that? Small fry, you got the screaming heebies on the stairs.
He'd stopped at a corner, panting, emitting breath in bursts of steam like a kettle.
They've put an elevator to the top now. One more temple to Hoover's swindlers, if you ask me.
He chuckled, tasting his clever remark again after the fact, like a belch. People were gathering here, a trolley stop. An officer clopped past on a huge bay horse.
Mother said you worked for President Hoover.
Who says I don't?
A hint of ire, suggesting he might not. Or not in any capacity Mr. Hoover would know about. A bean counter in a government office, Mother said, but one of the last men in America with a steady job, so it serves him right to get his boy sent him on the train.
President Hoover is the greatest man ever lived, he said,
overly loud. People looked.
They've just had a telephone put in on his desk for calling his chief of staff. He can get MacArthur quick as snapping his fingers. You think your president of Mexico has a telephone on his desk?
Mexico will be held as a grudge then, probably for reasons to do with Mother. Ortiz Rubio does have a telephone. The newspapers say he can't make a move without ringing up Calles first at his house on the Street of 40 Thieves in Cuernavaca. But Father didn't want to hear about that. People ask without wanting to know. He boarded the trolley through the brew of people, shouldering his way toward the seats. The trunk wouldn't fit under the wooden bench, but hunched in the aisle, an embarrassment. People coming on the trolley flowed around it like a river over a boulder. The ride was long. He stared out the window. It was impossible to imagine this man in the same room with Mother, the same bed. She would swat him like a fly, then call a maid to wipe up the residue. The men here wear suits like businessmen in Mexico City, but with more layers due to the cold. The women have complicated stuff, long scarves and things to put their hands in, hard to name. One had a shawl around her neck made from a whole fox with its head still on, biting its tail. If Cortez came here, he could write the queen a whole chapter about the lady's clothes. After many stops, Father said,
"We are going out to the school. They said it's best to start right away in your situation."
He spoke slowly, as if situation meant a boy with a damaged brain.
"It's bread and board. You'll bunk there with your pals, Harry.
Yes, sir. Harry? It will be Harry now?
That'll be a barrel of laughs.
He bit his mustache, then added,
It better be.
Meaning, it is costing some money. Harry Shepherd looked out the window. Whoever pays the bill names the boy. Scenes passed by. Marble edifices, parks of skeletal trees, boarded warehouses. Pale white men in black suits and hats. And then the opposite, dark-colored men in pale shirts and trousers, no hats at all. They were digging a long trench with pickaxes, their muscled arms bare, even in this cold. In all Mexico, there is not one Indian so black as those men. Their arms had a shine, like the rubbed wood of black piano keys. At the end of the trolley ride, a motor bus. The great trunk occupied its own seat, with a window for viewing the scenery of mansions strung along a river. Father took long fishing expeditions into his pocket to find his watch, pull it out, and frown at its face. Did he remember the other watch, the one Mother took, later on pinched again from her jewelry case? The memory of it feels like a sickness now. Not for the sin of thievery, but for the dreadful longing pinned to it. For this man, this father. January 17. Most lofty, excellent Empress, the place called Potomac Academy is marvelous bad. A prison camp in brick buildings built to look like mansions, where native leaders called officers rule over the captives. The dormitory is a long house of beds like a hospital, with every patient required to go dead at 21 hours. Lights out means no more reading or else. In the morning, the corpses rise again on command. The strangest thing, the captive boys don't seem to wish for escape. In class, they take their orders and knuckle under, but the minute the officer leaves the room, they commence to rapping heads with inkwells and aping the language of radio men named Amos and Andy. In the dormitory, they gawk at someone's eight-pager with a girl called Sally Rand in it, naked with feathery fans. She looks like a cold baby bird. The captives are released Saturday afternoon. No classes or exercises for once, and the dormitory empties out. Boys go to homes if they have them. The morning is chapel first, then mess hall, then freedom. All the other boys in Form 9 are younger, but taller than the cretins anyway, and less spittle. Form 9 was a compromise because of being too tall to go all the way back to Form 6. The officers teach Latin, maths, and other things, drill and psychomotricity. Best is literature. The officer recommended a pass to the Form 11 literature class, Samuel Butler, Daniel Defoe, and Jonathan Swift. Who gives a fig if they are restoration or neoclassicists? New books in endless supply. Drill is cleaning and display of firearms, not so different from cleaning dishes. Mathematics, the worst. Nothing past the tablas de multiplicar will ever fit in this calabash. Algebra, a language spoken on the moon, for a boy with no plans to go there. Sunday, January 24. Notes on how to speak in America. 1. Do not say, pardon me. People in books say it constantly. Here, they ask who sent you to prison. 2. Shouting, go fry asparagus, won't make them leave you alone, as it would in Spanish. 3. Beat it means go fry asparagus. 4. Punk means fluter. Also chump, ratso, and sure it ain't the YMCA. 5. Mexico is not a country but a name. Hey, Mexico, come here. The United States is the land of the square deal and the working stiff.
Even though the newspapers say nobody has a job and deals are not very geometric. The boys move in cloudish groups like schools of fish on the reef. In the hallways, the groups approach, pass by, and join up again behind, as if you were a rock, not a sentient being. A splay-legged thing dangling in the wrong world. February 21. So many people are sore at President Hoover, he had to chain up the gates to the White House and lock himself in, according to the boy named Bullseye. Yesterday, a one-armed vet tried to break through the gate, got his ass beat up, and was hauled off to the Hoosgow, where the one-armed man received his first square in a fortnight. Number 6. A square is a meal. Bullseye pinches newspapers and cigarettes from the officer's mess. When he pulls the papers out of his jacket in the lavatory, the boys crowd around. They can't wait for him to read his made-up headlines in the loud voice of a news hawker. Extry, hextry, chicken liver Hoover crawls under presidential bed. Mrs. Hoover to get some peace at last. The real name of Bullseye is Billy Boorseye. He isn't a regular student. He was, until his pop lost his job at a radio shop and his ma'am lost her marbles. Now he takes classes only half the day, then works in the kitchen and mops the lavs. At night he reads what he has swiped from teachers' desks, getting his education on the lam, he says. Bullseye has admirers, but no friends in here, he says. His friends are all on the outside. He gets to leave the grounds because of his job in the kitchen, the mess. The cooks send him to the butchers, the canvas man's, even the gunsmiths sometimes. He says the cooks need firearms for self-defense. The food is that bad. February 28. A logic problem. Is the tedium of maths class better or worse than the tedium of maths detention? Being held prisoner in the library with an algebra book is not improving, but that great hall full of books is not punishment either. For certain, it is safer than outdoors with boys shoulder-banging at American football, screaming in the language of gee whiz and your old man. March 13. Every morning, Bullseye stands naked in the lav, shaving his face. He looks 20. He says he's only the same age as everybody else here, plus a few hard knocks. He says you grow up fast when the South Sea bubble bursts and your dad gets the boot. He doesn't go home either. We have that in common, dads who won't look a son in the eye. He says it's good as any reason for friendship. It's the only one so far. The boy called Pencil, in the next bed, will talk if no one else is around. The Greek boy named Damos says, "Hey, Mexico, come here." But he also says, "Hey, Brush Ape." Bullseye told them to watch out. The kid from Mexico is ace at firearms. Maybe he used to ride with Pancho Villa. Now they use that name, Pancho Villa. It took a while to recognize it because they pronounce it something like Pantsville. Hey, Pantsville, come here. It sounds like a location, one of the hanging laundry neighborhoods you see from the train to Huichapan. March 14. Lucky Lindy's baby is kidnapped and everyone is afraid, even boys locked up in a brick school. For the hero who flew across the ocean, a terrible crash. The newspapers say any child is in danger if Lindy could be that unlucky. But this country already had bad luck people everywhere, sleeping in the parks, wearing newspapers for coats. The people who have good cloth coats look out the trolley windows and say, "Those bums need to buck up." Unlucky Lindy makes them afraid because it happened to a hero. March 20. Bullseye smells like peeled potatoes, cigarettes, and the mop bucket. When the others go home on Saturday, he says,
Hey, Pancho Villa, you are cordially invited to assist me with my labors. These include scrubbing the lunch mess, running with the wet mop in the commissary, jumping on it, and sliding across the floor between the long tables, and so forth. The assistant receives no pay except getting his head squeezed inside Bullseye's elbow and his hair scrubbed with knuckles. That is how boys touch here, Bullseye especially. March 27. Military strategy is interesting. Running an army is similar to running a household of servants. Mother is good at that kind of warfare. She has instincts for reconnaissance and the surprise attack. Officer Ostrain says the United States has the 16th largest army in the world, ranking leagues behind Great Britain, Spain, Turkey, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Romania, and many others. Mexico was not mentioned. Our poorly equipped military seems to offend Officer Ostrain to the limits of his brass-buttoned endurance. He says it's a disgrace that General MacArthur and Major Eisenhower have to stand on Pennsylvania Avenue waiting like common citizens for the Mount Pleasant trolley car to get to the Senate chambers. The boys say they have seen them, and Major Patton also, playing polo on Saturdays at Meyer Field. They want to grow up to have ponies like the generals and sport them around polo fields on Saturdays with Sally Rand riding behind, her breasts bouncing like footballs. That is why they never plot an escape from the academy. April 10. The K Street Market is like a piece of Mexico. The fish hawkers sing the same as on the Malecón, but in a kind of English. 4 bits of mackerel, ladies! Old women with teas and herbs promise to cure any ailment. The air smells like home. Charred meat, salt fish, horse dung. Going there today was like bursting through the surface of water and finally breathing, after being in a tunnel of dark for 13 Sundays. The outer part of the market has stalls selling leather goods, tea kettles, every earthly thing for anyone that still has a nickel to rub against a dime. Inedibles are sold on the outside of the market, comestibles in the interior. The knife grinders with big, naked arms stand at the entrance to the butcher's avenue. Oystermen in white aprons wheel full carts up from the wharves. The cilindro man has one missing ear and a monkey in a blue cap to dance to his organ music. Women sell figs and roses, eggs and sausages, chickens and cheese, racks of dressed rabbits, even live birds in cages, like the market in Coyoacán. One woman sells conejillos de Indias. Bullseye says they are not called Indian rabbits here, but Guinean pigs. He has no good explanation for it, and agrees they are probably more rabbit than pig. This morning, he told the head cook he needed an assistant for his errands at the market. "Have a heart," Bullseye told her. "You're asking for more than one poor sod can carry." His first destination is the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, which he calls the A&P, and which sells more than tea. The week's supply of rice, beef, flour, coffee, and 50 more things for the Potomac Academy go into crates from there onto a horse truck every Saturday. The week's changes to the list have to be brought in person. The shop men want a boy to help with the boxing up. Other things are purchased from the rest of the market. The boy for the errand is Bullseye, and now his assistant, Pancho Villa. It took hours to get to the A&P. With so many swell things to look at on the way, dogs to be fed, friends to cuff on the shoulder, blue-black workmen to be stared at as they pick open a trench as long as Pennsylvania Avenue. Where do they come from?
Africa, of course, was Bullseye's reply.
From Africa? All that way? Just for the job of digging ditches?
No, you lob. They were slaves first. Before they all got put free by Abe Lincoln. Didn't you ever hear the slaves?
Maybe, but not like these. Mexico didn't have them. A lob is a pendejo. But Bullseye will answer questions that can't be asked of other boys. Those dark men and their wives can't shop here or ride the trolleys, he said. It's against the law. Even to get lunch in a restaurant, if one of them needs to make water whilst digging the ditch on Pennsylvania Avenue, or get a drink, he has to walk 2 miles out 7th Street to find a restaurant that will let him touch a glass or use the lav. It's a strange way. Being a servant, making a bad wage, that is no puzzle. All the richest men in Mexico were once lifted from the cradle by servants. But they all drink from the same water jar that fills the master's glass, and they use the same chamber pot, still warm from the piss of the patron. In Mexico, nobody ever thought to keep those streams flowing separately. April 17. School is closing 2 weeks for Easter holiday. Then comes the end of term soon, and summer. Most of the boys will go home, but not all. Some have to stay for remedial maths and repeating Virginia history in the sweat of July. Living here in the sock-stinking dormitory, and not with Father. He clearly explained that in his letter about coming to visit while school is closed for Easter holiday. That will be swell, he says, a visit with old Dad. Swell enough for 2 weeks, not the whole summer. Nothing here counts for anything now but Saturdays, going to the market with Billy Bullseye. The rest is just coasting with half-closed eyes through another week. May 3. Father's explanations made no mention of a lady. She must have cleared out of his apartment in a hurry to make way for the Easter visitor. On the QT, Father is putting on the feed bag with a dame. Dust-colored stockings hang like cobwebs on the bathroom radiator. A lipstick winks like gossip on the bureau. Why would he hide her? Does he not know about Mother and her swains? He should listen through her wall some night if he thinks his son is unacquainted with bedroom jolly-ups and pig-fights. Or he would lose some bargaining score if the dame is reported back to Mexico. He and Mother are still not divorced because of the Mexican paperwork. Divorce, he pronounces like a taste of soup with too much salt. Her name, he says, like the Lord's taken in vain. Sometimes he says Mexico, and the word has nothing in it at all, a wall with no colors painted on it. May 5. A trip to the museum with the father figure. The weather has gone from freezing to broiling, with some talk of cherry blossoms in between. People on the trolley press against you in a crush, men in white linen suits, girls in sailor dresses and felt turbans. The smell of perspiration is different here. Cortez could write about that also. Most excellent empress, the sweat of the northern people has a redolent stench. Maybe because of so many layers of clothes. Father's white suit hangs limp from his shoulders, wilting by the minute, like the moonflowers in the garden in Isla Pichol. Smithsonian is the name of the museum, a brick castle containing the stuffed dead skins of every species but our own. Why not a few humans, too? Father laughed at that one, like a man in some kind of a show, with an audience. His mood has shifted. Now he seems to take his son as a joke rather than a serious offense. The museum had rooms of things from Tenochtitlan and other ancient sites of Mexico, fabulous artworks in gold that Cortez did not manage to carry off, now in Washington instead. On the ride back to Father's apartment, the trolley passed a long park, a row of warehouses, and then the most amazing spectacle, a city of tents and shacks roiling with people. Cooking fires, children, laundry hanging on lines. A Mexican village of the very poorest kind set down in the middle of Washington City, surrounded by office buildings. A hand-lettered sign said, "Bonus Expeditionary Encampment." The American flag hung about in multiples over the shacks like laundry, blending in with the laundry, really. The flags were as sun-faded as the upside-down trousers on the lines. The size of the camp was astonishing. A whole nation of beggars arrived in the capital.
"That lot," Father spat through his mustache. "They've run their hobo jungle all the way down Pennsylvania. I have to pass through all that to get to work every morning."
A woman in a headscarf held up a naked baby toward our trolley. The baby waved its arms. A hobo jungle is unlike other jungles where monkeys howl through the leafy air. What do they all want?
What does anybody want? Something for nothing, of course.
In that moment, Father sounded like Bullseye. But why so many of them, and all the flags?
They're war veterans, or so they say, because vets are entitled to a soldier's bonus. They want their bonus.
Ragged men stood at military attention every few meters, like fence posts all along the edge of the camp facing the street. Veteran soldiers, you could tell it from the placement of feet and shoulders. But their eyes searched the passing trolley with a terrifying hunger.
"They've been here all week? What do the families live on?" "Shoe leather soup, I'd say."
"Those men fought in France? With mustard gas and everything?" Father nodded. "We studied the Argonne. In military strategy, it was very bad." Another nod. "So, can't they get their money now? If they fought in the war?"
"I'd have been there, too, in the Argonne," he said, suddenly turning pinkish. "If I could have been. Did your mother tell you I wouldn't fight in the war?"
A subject to steer around. "What's the soldier's bonus supposed to be?" Surprisingly, Father knew the answer. $500 a man. He is a bean counter for the government. $500 for risking a life in the war so they could begin a new one here. Congress turned them down, decided to pay out the bonus later when these men are old. So they've come here from everywhere, wishing to take the matter up with the president.
Does Mr. Hoover mean to meet with them? Not on your life. If they want to talk to him, they better use the telephone.
May 14. Going with Bullseye to the market that first time was like Mother's first cigarette in the morning. Now every minute is a long piece of waiting, fidgeting out the minutes, pecking the desk, trying to think of something else until Saturday, living in dread of not being asked again. On Friday nights, the boys raise a cloud of stink in the barracks, throwing dirty drawers in satchels to get ready for the weekend, and then they fall down asleep, leaving only the sound of one cricket ratcheting, a slant of puny moonlight, an hour or two for thinking, Billy Bullseye, will he ask tomorrow or not? Who cares? A person could prowl the library instead, in peace for once. Find some book that's better than noisy K Street. Keeping up with that big, rough-elbowed Dodger is worse than American football. It takes forever to get anywhere. Bullseye knows every third fellow he sees, not just boys but men of all sorts. And then has to renew the acquaintance with shoulder jabs and insults while the tag-along stands watching like a pet dog. What does it matter if he asks or not? June 17. The barracks have emptied. Almost all the boys went home for summer, collected by servants in fancy carriages or mothers in horse-drawn taxis. It was entertaining to see which ones were rich or not. They all act like imperial kings when the parents aren't here. Tomorrow begins a real job for pay. Pearl diving, Bullseye calls it, washing dishes in the mess hall. Father arranged it to cover board over the summer. But this afternoon, nothing yet to do in the empty barracks but take out every pair of pants from the footlocker and fold it up again, or sit on the bed with the Odyssey, until the head of Bullseye appears around the door, all ears and smile, the half-bit haircut.
"Hey, you bookworm, too busy lollygagging then?"
"Too busy for what? The book claps shut.
Noodle juice and cookies with Mrs. Hoover. What you think for what? An ankle excursion.
K Street. The smile disappears because the whole boy disappears. The Odyssey can be reopened to any page, it doesn't matter which. And then he is back, that grin. The scion of a ruined family, delighted with himself. This hurts, an ache in the groin, wanting so badly to see that smile and follow it somewhere. It keens like mother waiting for the next cigarette. That is how she loves men, too. It must be. But in this case, can't be.
What doesn't kill you, Bullseye likes to observe while scrubbing pots in the mess, will make you piss on your shoes.
June 28. President Hoover asked the Treasury Secretary for a nickel to telephone a friend. Secretary Mellon said, "Here's a dime, phone both of them." According to Bullseye, 2 million Americans are on the road. Half are probably just boys, not lucky enough to scrub pots for 3 squares and a plunk. Or farmers, radio repairmen, teachers, nurses, or they finish school and no job anywhere. "It gripes my soul, truly it does," says Bullseye. He is steamed about the relief bill passed by the Congress, then knocked right down by the President because it's an unexampled raid on the public treasury. That was the news headline. Hoover says it's no crisis, only depression, everyone down in the dumps feeling sorry for themselves. If the gloomy people would buck up and smile, this mess will go away.
July 16. Only 22 boys are taking summer classes, most of them living at home. In the long, echoing barracks, it's only Bullseye and Pancho Villa in the 2-end beds, and all the others empty. It feels like a hospital at the conclusion of a plague. Bullseye has a friend living in the Bonus Army encampment, Nicky Angelino, a cousin of his mother's from Pennsylvania. Sometimes Nicky can be tracked down in the tent village, sometimes not. There are so many there now, acres of humankind, and people living under tar paper tend to move around a good deal. Everyone at the camp knows Nick Angelino, though. Famously, he scaled the White House fence without arrest and left a gift on Hoover's doorstep, his medals from the Argonne and a picture of his family. Angelino has a girl he calls his wife, but she looks too young in her thin, short dress. To cover her breasts, she wears a green knobbled sweater, even in the heat. Their baby wears old shirts torn up for nappers. He was born last month here in the encampment. The girl won't talk about it. The smell of the Bonus Expeditionary Force always comes first. Cooking smells, latrine smells. Pew! A clock on the head from Bullseye for saying that. What? It stinks. Nothing. Bullseye gets angry easily at the camp. What nothing? You hit me. Pew, says you. Here's 100,000 men that served your country.
My country is Mexico.
Damn you.
Okay, they served our country.
And here's their girls and kids with nothing and no place. All they want is what the government says they got coming, and you say, pew.
Well, crap stinks, even if it came from a hero's ass.
You know what it said in the paper? The Bonus marchers are not content with the pensions already received, although 7 or 8 times those of other countries. The New York goddamn Times!
What pensions already received?
None. They got no red cent so far, after discharge.
How could the newspaper say that if it's a lie?
Lob. If the president lies, why wouldn't they?
Bullseye frowned, scanning the crowd for Nicky.
How can the government refuse to pay if they served?
They got VFW certificates they're supposed to cash in. But now they have to wait 10 more years because of the bank crisis. That wasn't the deal when they shipped out. If Congress can't pay the soldiers, they shouldn't be declaring war on the Krauts.
Gee whiz.
See those two behind the bread truck? They're the men from the VA checking papers on the people waiting for the free bread. They won't turn a guy away anyhow, but they said it's running 94%.
94% what? Certain your old man's your dad?
Lob, I talked to him yesterday. That many have got Army or Navy discharge papers, or wives of men with records. 1 in 5 disabled.
Bullseye decided to look in the warehouse district. Men with families are starting to move their broods up there now, into the old brick hulks on Pennsylvania, camping out in condemned buildings. Blue and white flags of laundry hung out of almost every warehouse window. Kids ran out of the big open doors, and so did smells, cooking, cabbage, the inside of a shoe. Bullseye followed the bread wagon up Pennsylvania, hoping to spot Nicky in the crowd that pressed around the truck. The bread comes from a bakery in New York, he says, a bunch of vets with jobs who got together and send it here for free, even though the papers say these men are rioters, unpatriotic to help rioters. If a reporter came down here, he might notice there isn't any riot. Only Nick Angelino climbing the fence to leave a picture of his baby. Angelino was located at last, carrying a loaf of bread and his wrapped-up son of about the same size. He tried to wave, looking as if he might drop one or the other. Bullseye went loping to catch him. He loves Nick's stories of riflemen and trenches and gas and men going blind in the war. The Argonne is a fantastic story these men all marched through together, and in the end, it led here. July 22. Summer more than half gone. Soon the boy army will return to take the place over again, making it loud. But for now, the dormitory is still a camp for two tramps on the rods. Bullseye pretends he's a hobo, pulling out his Hoover flags, empty pockets turned inside out. Sometimes, for a joke, he covers himself with Hoover blankets, his newspapers. When it's hot, he sits on his bed with nothing on at all, pumping his muscles like a wrestler, talking half the night, smoking fags he's pinched from the officer's mess. Tonight, the moon is 5 days past full, bleeding white blood into the sky. Si como Cristo. Nobody else, only Bullseye, sitting there naked as Sally Rand, behaving as if he thinks he's quite worth looking at, too. Eye to eye, holding that stare as he leans back against the wall. The moon lighting up the smoke over his head like storm clouds. Every place the light touches his skin, he is a statue made of marble. All but the hairs on his chest. What are you staring at?
Nothing.
Go back to Mexico, then.
All right, sure. It's gonna happen.
Bullseye stared. When?
What do you care?
He came over and sat on this bed, took the lit fag out of his mouth. Smoke this. It makes you dizzy, but then you feel good.
Okay.
But the dizziness was there already. Dizziness and ache from seeing everything the moon was allowed to touch. July 25. Staying on for fall term is contingent on passing the summer classes. Bullseye says they should pay us more for pearl diving.
We should go and march with the bonus army. Bullseye laughs. Tell it to Sweeney.
July 28. Today was terrible. The end of summer term should be a fine day, and instead, people killed. If you ever think a day is fine, you weren't paying attention. Probably somebody was getting clapped bloody while you ate your breakfast. It happened right in front of us. The heat was bad on K Street, but Bullseye kept yelling to hurry up into the thick of the encampment. Men standing on the back gate of the bread truck were passing out loaves into all those hands, like in the Bible, loaves floating from hand to hand.
The encampment has changed shape all summer. It started at the riverbank, but grew and swelled up into the warehouses on Pennsylvania, where the whole thing started today. With Bullseye scooting right toward the fight, a course, a moth to the candle, and there's no keeping up with him. But the moth at the candle dies. He survives every time, yelling his head off that it was going to be a real sockdolager. It was the police superintendent on his blue motorcycle, sent down to kick the bonus army families out of the warehouses. They're supposed to be tearing those down to build more temples. Bullseye said, "Glassford's in a jam." The superintendent, Hoover, is on his neck for letting people get in the warehouses in the first place and wants them kicked out today. Some people who'd been watching since early morning said two companies of Marines in their helmets had already come to do the job, sent down there by Vice President Curtis on trolley cars. And Glassford sent them back, ready to spit, because the Vice President has no authority over military troops. "Is that true?" "Asking me," Bullseye said. "You seen me in government class?" Now the superintendent was sweating in his brass-buttoned uniform, taking off his helmet and wiping his forehead a lot as he talked with the bonus army men. His job on the line. But those families, on a worse line, surely. The crowd of gawkers was growing. Two men in white suits arrived in a limousine, also sweating, and had words with Glassford, gesturing at the building. Bullseye pushed to get closer, nearly tipping an old man with a shopping basket on his arm. The old man was mad as bugs, shouting at the police, "Where was you in the Argonne, buddy?" You wouldn't have guessed the fellow had so much air in him. Other people picked it up, shouting things too. "They risked life and limb in France. You're running them out like dogs." But mostly, the crowd was quiet, waiting to see how it would go. A banner painted on a bedsheet furled out a second-story window. "God bless our home." "All right, then, we're off to K Street," said Bullseye suddenly, and off he headed toward the AMP. For once, his magnet for trouble failed him, and he was putting sacks of corn grits in a crate at the back of the store when the showdown started. A woman came running in the front door screaming that Officer Glassford had been shot. Bullseye took off at a lope. The story changed many times before we could get to the scene. Glassford was dead, or else he wasn't. He'd finally ordered the area cleared and got hit with a brick thrown out a window of the warehouse. That was how it went, people talking and running for the scene, and at the warehouse it was bedlam. Women streaming out the door carrying cook pots and children, a lot of crying and screaming. Some bonus army men lay bloody in the street. Shot, maybe dead. Bullseye looked ready to murder. More men were roaring up from the main encampment by the river. They'd gotten wind and come running with bricks to defend their women and kids, and Glassford's men returned fire with bullets. They weren't even ashamed. Scads of people saw them do it. The whole crowd was screaming. Like Cortez and the Aztecs, one side always better armed. An ambulance sounded from far away, probably stuck. The mob was like an ocean now, shifting from side to side. Nothing could get through. The only thing running fast was rumors. Hoover had called up MacArthur to put on his whipcord breeches, get down here with troops, and rout the bonus army. Half the city stood jammed together on the hottest day of the year. Offices were letting out, all eyes watching to see what would happen to these women and men. They stood on the step of a wrecked building, clutching what was left of their lives in a wad at their bellies, and every shopper and businessman, idler and schoolboy, felt a horror rise, wondering the same thing. Where can they go? A grumbling sound like thunder seemed to come out of the street. An out-of-breath newsboy grabbed the corner of a building as he came round it and flung himself against the wall, gasping. "It's a tank!" he shouted. "The treads are turning the pavement into gravy!" It seemed a fair time to leave,
But escape was impossible. The front of the crowd began backing up from the street, shoving the rest of us against the window of a telegraph office, jammed between men in straw boaters and secretaries in point-heeled shoes. Two girls in cloche hats, one white hat and one black, stepped out of the door of the telegraph office and said, "Gee, what's the story?" People were pouring out of buildings with nowhere to go, milling in the street across from the bonus marchers. The cavalry arrived just then, clopping up the street. It was Major Patton. Probably he'd arrived ahead of MacArthur's tanks because the horses could dodge around the stalled motor cars choking up Pennsylvania Avenue. The horses reared and pranced sideways, spooked by the crowd. Their riders had long sabers held high in their right hands. Behind them came a machine gun detachment, audibly marching in step. "Gee whiz!" said the white hat girl again. Bayonets appeared, bristling above the heads of the crowd. People pressed back harder against the buildings as the tanks rolled up, their treads chewing the road as they came. The bonus marchers were lined up across the street, standing steady. Women struggled to hold babies, but all the men stood at attention, like the soldiers they are. They saluted the cavalry's color guard, and one small ragged boy on a man's shoulders pumped his own little flag in the air. A lady in the crowd of onlookers raised up a high shout, and the whole throng took it up. "Three cheers for our men who served! Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!" Patton's horsemen wheeled and charged the crowd. Everyone ducked and shoved, the white hat girl screaming, stepping sideways with her pointed white shoe, stabbing like a knife, and everyone tumbled. "Pull her up quick," Bullseye said, helping from his side to drag her up by the elbows, but she seemed to be swooning. A man fell against her, someone else against the man, and then it was a whole smash-up of secretaries and bean counters. With flat hands pressed against the stone wall of the telegraph office, it was possible to inch back up to standing. Bullseye began to swim with his elbows toward the street while everyone else pressed back, and that was a good time to say so long to Bullseye. Between the stone wall and the crush of shoulders, it was hard to breathe. Over the sea of heads and hats, you could catch sight of cavalrymen leaning down from the waist on their horses, flailing their saber blades against whatever was below them. Against people. That hit with a shock. They were beating at the bonus army men and women with the razor-sharp blades of sabers. Someone pushed into the near crowd with a bloody face, the meat of his cheek sliced back and bone shining. Roar after roar rose from the crowd in front, leaving those at the rear to guess and dread the cause of it. The cavalrymen kept shouting to clear out, but the crowd shouted, "Shame! Shame!" until it became a chant. The bonus army had linked arms to form a colonnade across the street, and the cavalry flung their horses through the line, snapping bones. The crowd howled, screams erupting with every charge of horsemen into flesh. Bullseye suddenly reappeared. "Come on!" "We can't get through. I'm smashed potatoes." Bullseye swung open the door of the telegraph office and, like a magician pulling a scarf through a ring, yanked us both through the knot of people into the office. The people trapped inside all looked up, the same shocked face. "Back to the alley!" Bullseye yelled, but no one else made for it as he threaded through the desks and clerks to the washroom, climbed onto the radiator, and popped open the window. Outside, the alleyway was surprisingly empty. Trash heaps and crates of sodden lettuce. It must be a restaurant next door. It was a stench to beat the band. Not one other person had thought to escape from the melee by this route. Bullseye turned south at a hard trot. "School's the other way." "Right," he said, without slowing up. A burning stench began to choke out the restaurant smell. "God," Bullseye croaked. "It's gas! Come on, this way or we're cooked!" People came into the alley with hands over their faces, coming from the direction of the river. What followed was the sight of blindness itself coming on, and a feeling exactly like trying to breathe salt water, like swimming into the cave, the longest possible held breath. Every gulp of air tasted like poison. People were stumbling over trash heaps and people heaps. A newsboy curled like a fetus on his big stack of papers. Suddenly, the whole pile was old news.
"Come on," Bullseye said. "He's not dead. You don't die of gas."
Bullseye's face was purple as liver, his eyes streaming tears, but he still moved at a clip that wasn't easy to follow. An ambulance entered the alley, and people mobbed it. Between two buildings, a tableau of the riot appeared. An infantryman pulling a blue bottle from his belt, uncorking it, and hurling it into the haze.
July 29. It's all in the newspapers today. Bullseye sat reading on his bed without a word, handing the papers over when he finished reading each part. Gallinger Hospital filled to overflowing with the casualties. Any bonus marchers who made it to the 11th Street Bridge joined the ones at the riverbank encampment. Mr. Hoover sent orders for troops to stop at the bridge, but MacArthur couldn't be bothered with new orders, so he mounted machine guns on the bridge and led a column of infantry across the Potomac into the encampment. They set flaming torches to the canvas and pasteboard homes. Exactly as Cortez said it, "Much grieved to burn up the people, but since it was still more grievous to them, he determined to do it." It was shameful to read those newspapers, to feel any eagerness for knowing each awful detail of the massacre. How the artillery marched right over the camp on the riverbank, destroying the hobo jungle of fruit crates, chicken coops, tar paper shacks, and dirt-colored tents. God bless our home. Families must have been kneeling in there, praying for any miracle a tight-fisted God might have left for them. The Bonus Army families had crops planted in their camp. Every Saturday this summer, Bullseye had pointed those out. How we cheered for the measly cornrows sprouting by the Potomac. They made the encampment look like Mexico, a real village where people might live and eat. Hungry kids were waiting for those almost ready ears after months of porridge, sweet corn roasted in the coals. To think of MacArthur's horses trampling it on purpose, somehow that small part of the story made tears come. Bullseye never came to bed after lights out. He turned up hiding in the infirmary, sitting hunched on the side of a bed, smoking, with more newspapers. "Look at this," he threw it. The penalty for prowling around after lights out is severe, but the infirmary was deserted. The late extra? After sunset yesterday, the flames in the Anacostia encampment rose 50 feet in the air and spread to the surrounding woods. 6 companies of firemen were required to defend adjacent property. The president observed from the White House windows an unusual glow in the eastern sky and conceded MacArthur was right to proceed with the routing. In his opinion, the Bonus Army consists of communists and persons with criminal records. The editorial writer applauded MacArthur for sparing the public treasury. "The nation is being bled dry by persons like these who offend the common decency." Why would the paper say they're criminals? "They were treated like criminals," Bullseye replied. "So people want to think it. The paper says whatever they want." It was no use reading more, but hard to stop. The late extra had photos, a society page. While soldiers poured gasoline on the shacks, the upper crust were cruising the river on their yachts, watching MacArthur spare the public treasury. A Mrs. Harcourt required medical attention after she saw a small boy receive a bayonet through his lower body. Senator Hiram Bingham of Connecticut was badly jostled on the street in front of the warehouse while attempting to leave his office. His injuries were not mortal, but earned as many newspaper inches as all the others together,
including a woman in the Anacostia camp who lost her sight to flaming gasoline thrown in her face, and the vets from the Argonne shot dead in their own country. A dozen kids got shattered limbs or broken skulls. Two infants died of inhaling gas. Was one of them Nick's baby, do you think? Bullseye kept his head turned away. For Christ's sake, he said, a gas bomb costs more than 100 loaves of bread.
Archivist's note. The next journal after this one will not appear to the reader, for it was destroyed in 1947. This note presents an intrusion, and I beg pardon for it. The notebook was burned in a metal tar bucket outdoors on a September evening at the start of a rain. Mr. Shepherd watched through an upstairs window. The one doing the burning was myself. It was a slim book of lined paper and cotton duck binding with Potomac Academy stamped on it, a type of thing issued to the boys there, probably in great number. But this one in particular he had used for a diary, in 1933. It isn't my place to give an opinion about the burning. I'm a typist. But he made it plain he didn't want that little book to reach the public view, nor any of these personal writings, truth be told. He was averse to making himself known, even when greatly misunderstood. He liked to say, Dios habla por el que calla, meaning, God speaks for the silent man. If he believed that, after all that happened, I am not sure how. So, any regrets over the missing Potomac Academy 1933 would not be his. Evidently, the notebook had something in it to disturb him, and he decided to destroy it. Later, he would make the same judgment about all the rest of his diaries. But that particular one he plucked out first from among all the notebooks and pages he kept in portmanteau bindings on a shelf in his study. I won't try to say why a man would write pages he meant no one to see, let alone keep them nice in bindings. The sole place he let his words be seen was in the books published with his name on their spines. Harrison Shepherd. You might think of him as your friend when closing one of these books. Many did. But he never let any photograph of himself go on the dust jacket to encourage that kind of feeling. Even though he was a good-looking man, well-groomed with dark hair and Roman features, about 6 feet and 5 inches in height. He did not have physical deformities, as has been said. The height alone was unusual. But maybe you'll not have heard of him at all, nor have any idea why you should have, until reading all this here. The notebook that burned, then. People who make a study of old documents have a name for this very kind of thing, a missing piece. A lacuna, it's called. The hole in the story, and this one truly missing still. I know it is gone and won't turn up later in any trunk, as that first little leather-bound one finally did. The burned book, from the Potomac Academy, probably described his friendships and so forth until his leaving the school in 1934, midway through the graduation year. I didn't read it before putting it to the flame. I am not concealing any scandal. Mr. Shepherd spoke of having made a disaster of his schooling, but said little else of it. He went back to Mexico then to live with his mother, who had abandoned her liaison with the American, and found work as a seamstress in a Coyoacan dress shop. Mr. Shepherd and his mother accumulated some disagreements. He took a position again with the painter Diego Rivera as a plaster mixer to start. By late in the year 1935, he was paid as a member of their household staff. Some writings did survive from his time at the Potomac Academy, sheafs of typewritten pages describing battle scenes and dialogues he later used in his novel, Vassals of Majesty, published in 1945. But as to the journal, his express wish was to see it removed from this earth.
In time, with full voice and sound mind, he expressed that same wish for the other journals, too. All these now collected in a volume. I didn't make this plain at the beginning. I do so now. If you're of the mind to honor a dead man's wishes, always and regardless, be now fairly warned. If you feel it is best or kindest, then put these pages down and read no more. Signed, V.B. Part 3. San Angel and Coyoacan, 1935 to 1941. Initialed V.B. Directions for making empanadas dulces. They can be triangular or curled like snails with the filling inside. The dough is the same either way. White flour with lard and a little salt rubbed in. Beat egg yolks into a little cold water, as many eggs as Olunda will spare. Then mix the liquid lake into the volcano of flour, exactly like mixing plaster. Roll the dough in a rectangle as wide as the whole counter in this kitchen, which is so small, if two ants are in the sugar, it's already too crowded in here. Next, with a clean machete, cut the dough into squares like little handkerchiefs. Spoon some filling on each one and fold it diagonally to make a triangle. The square of the hipotenusa can go to hell. The filling can be custard or pineapple. For the custard, heat a liter of milk and some sugar with pieces of cinnamon. Beat 7 egg yolks with some cornstarch and pour it in a thin stream into the boiling milk. Stir until your arm is falling off. The lechecilla will be yellow and very thick. For pineapple filling, cook the fruit with brown sugar syrup and star anise. The other way to make them is to spread the filling over the whole rectangle of dough and roll it into a log, then cut off round pieces, each one like a snail. For that, use the pineapple filling. The custard will make a devil of a mess. Bake the pastries in the oven, if you live in a normal house. If you live in a super-modern house dreamed up by an idiot, go next door to the San Angel Inn. One of the cooks there, Montserrat, will meet you at the back door and take your trays to bake in the kitchen. She'll send one of the hotel girls to tell you when they're done. Those are the instructions. If your boss has the appetite of an elephant and a kitchen the size of an insect, this is how to keep your job. Do it exactly this way, because he said, "Write out the recipe, mijo, in case you ever leave me the way she did. You're the only person who knows how to cook like my wife." What he doesn't know is the servants did the cooking, not her, right from the beginning when they still lived with her parents. After they moved here, secretly, she had most of the meals picked up from the San Angel next door. The girl Candelaria is the angel of the birdcage, sighted years ago in the Melchor market hurrying behind her mistress. It took a few days of working here to be sure she is the same servant. It's not a face you forget. Smooth skin, the countenance of a village girl, hair that reaches her knees. Olunda makes her tie her braids in loops for safety and hygiene. Her mistress, the Azteca queen, is gone, but Candelaria remains. Could there be an uglier house in all Mexico than this one? Funcionalismo, architecture as ugly as a fence made of dung. Except the fence here is the nicest part, a row of organ cactus surrounding the courtyard, planted so close together you can only see cracks of light between them. From upstairs, you can look over it to the inn across the road and a field where some cattle graze. San Angel is only 2 bus stops from the edge of the city, just 1 from Coyoacan. Yet here is a farmer working in his field with an iron-bladed hoe that looks like it was forged during the reign of Moctezuma. When he stops to rest, that poor old man has to raise his eyes to this modern mess of glass and painted cement that looks like a mistake. It looks like a baby giant was playing with his blocks when his mother called him, so he ran away and left his toys lying in Calle Alta Vista. 2 blocks, the big pink one and small blue one, standing separately, each with rooms stacked one above the other, screwed together by a curved cement staircase. The big pink block is the painter's domain, and his studio on the 2nd floor is not so bad. That window is the size of a lake, a whole wall of glass looking down at the neighbor's trees. The planks of the floor are yellow, like sun on your face. That room feels like someone could be happy in it. Everything else feels like being shut up inside a crate. The small blue block is meant to be for the small wife. Servants are only allowed up the staircase as far as the kitchen, which is not worth the trip. Her rooms above it are sealed like a crypt since the queen moved out. Good riddance, says Olunda.
She won't be back, I promise you. I'll eat a live dog if she ever shows up here again, after she caught master with his pants down as usual, but this time humping her own sister.
What a strange couple. Why would a man and wife live in separate houses? With only a little bridge between them, red pipe railings connecting one roof to the other. You can see it from the inn across the street. Functionalist tonteria. He is the one who eats, but the kitchen is on her side. If you manage to cook anything, you have to carry it down the staircase, which is like the inside of someone's ear, outside into the blazing sun to cross the gravel courtyard, then up the other cement ear to the studio where the master stands with his pants belted high on his giant dumpling belly, waiting to be fed. And now he says she's coming back. He wants her greeted with empanadas and budines and enchiladas tapatías. He has never put his 2 giant feet in this tiny kitchen, or he would know. You might as well try to make enchiladas in a peanut shell. Mixing plaster was easier. But living with mother was not. So he'll have his enchiladas. November 30. Live dogs, beware of Olunda. The mistress has come back after all. Moved back in with her furniture and strange collections packed into the rooms above the kitchen. It was like a surgery to carry her bed up the stair and through the narrow cement doorways without breaking out a glass block wall. Candelaria and Olunda went up to help and came back with hair standing on end. She has a pet monkey, they swear. He hides and leaps on your back when you carry food into her studio. Olunda moved her cot out of the little salon below the kitchen because the mistress wants that space for a dining room. Olunda would rather sleep in the laundry closet under the house anyway. The monkey is the least of it. The little queen has a temper like mother's. This servant's quarter out in the courtyard is probably the safest place to be, even with Cesar the flatulent for a roommate. He says this little block house wasn't meant to be a servant's quarter. They put it in the corner of the courtyard for keeping the motor car. But the painter decided to let the motor car reside on Alta Vista Street to make room for its driver in here. He says the architect planned for no driver or servants' quarters because he was a communist, like the painter. Olunda agrees. They said it was to be a revolutionary house, free of class struggle, no servants' rooms because they didn't believe in laundry maids or cooks. Nobody does, really. Why should they? Only in having clean clothes, clean floors, and enchiladas tapatillas.